Why don't we go around the room just very quickly and have people introduce themselves and say a word about their relevance to the topic of exports. I'm Larry Summers. I lead the President's National Economic Council and believe that with the consumer unlikely to drive the economy over the next decade, that our ability to export is going to be central to our ability to generate a return to full employment.
Well, I'm Farooq Athwari. I'm chairman and CEO of Ethan Allen. Now, Ethan Allen, we are a 77-year-old company, started as a manufacturer, and now we are in sort of vertically integrated retailing. And we still manufacture about over 60% in the United States. And we have 30 stores in China, and about 50% we are shipping from here. Small amount. And I believe that the only way we can be good at exporting overseas is if we are very good in the United States in meeting the needs here. If we are not good as a manufacturer for meeting the needs of the United States, there's no way we can export our products. So I come from that perspective, and we can talk more about, you know, what we need to do.
I'm Susan Collins. I'm the Dean of the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. I'm an international economist, and some introductory comments would be, it seems to me that certainly over the medium to longer run, and in the shorter run in some dimensions as well, that exports have to be a critical part of any kind of growth and employment strategy. If you look at the U.S. economy and compare it to other very large economies, the U.S. before the crisis was only exporting about 11% of its GDP. In contrast, the European Union 15 were exporting closer to 15 to 16% of GDP. There's tremendous room for growth. If you look at prospects worldwide, the growth in demand is primarily, or is to a large extent, in emerging markets. And so there are strategies that focus on shifting from the U.S. consumer to global consumers more generally, and that involves some shifts in products that would include services as well as manufacturing products. And so it seems to me that's clearly a room for growth. In the short run, there's some recovery from the crisis, but in the medium to long run, there is considerable space, and important to focus on the ways to get there.
We're just going around the room introducing ourselves and saying a word about our nexus to exports.
My name is Bill Ossie. I'm from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, a company called Midamar Corporation. I started the company in 1975 after spending time in the Peace Corps, Vietnam and Saudi Arabia. When I was in the Peace Corps, about 40% of the children by the time of the age of 5 died from protein deficiency. And I saw a common denominator from Senegal, across all of the Middle East, Africa, and Asia, went back to Iowa State, and decided to start a company called Midamar, Mid-America Agricultural Research for Development, and now we export to about 35 countries, primarily quality food products. We do all exports. We bring money home. We don't send it out, and we'll talk later about some international ideas and exports.
I'm Bob Iger from the Walt Disney Company. We're in multiple businesses that touch export business in one way or another. One is the manufacture or creation of intellectual property, movies and television, largely done in the United States and exported around the world. The movie business in the U.S. is one of the few businesses that has a positive balance of trade with most countries that it does business with. It's vital to the future of the movie business that intellectual property is protected from rampant growth in piracy, which would ultimately destroy the business, damage our ability to continue to support it and support the jobs, roughly 2.5 million direct and indirect in the United States. We also at Disney export what I'll call the brand, which is the qualities that are Disney, around the world that actually cause people to come visit the United States, mostly to our theme parks in Florida and in California. So in essence, it's importing a sensibility and brand attributes, exporting rather, in order for people to actually decide to come to the U.S., which not only supports direct creation of jobs for the Walt Disney Company, but the creation of thousands of jobs in the travel and tourism business around the country. One of the more interesting things there that we're finding, or we found over the last number of years, is that traveling to the United States is extremely difficult for people from markets as developed as Western Europe and as less developed as markets in Latin America and Asia. And that's becoming a bigger problem. We're less hospitable than we used to be, either because the infrastructure doesn't exist to bring people to the United States as comfortably and as easily as it used to be, or because for security reasons we simply made it tougher for people to enter and made them feel less comfortable when they do.
I'm Ursula Burns, I'm the CEO of Xerox Corporation. And we're a $17.5 billion technology-based document and business process management company. Over half of our revenues, 50% of our revenues, and 60% of our profits come from outside the United States. Interestingly enough, we are a homegrown company, started in upstate New York, and we've transformed ourselves into an export company. It is getting more difficult, much more difficult to get the talent that we need to keep this engine going. Significantly more difficult to eat profits out of the United States, which helps us, as my colleague said, invest so that we can actually export more. So my interest is to make sure that we have the engine, the full cycle engine going from education all the way through to product and profit.
Jim McNerney from Boeing. I believe we are the country's largest exporter. And the way we think about it is we aggregate per airplane about 4 million parts and export a lot of them. About half of those parts come from 22,000 small business suppliers that we aggregate as part of the system. And so we don't see the big business, small business distinction in the same way that some do. We think of it as a one ecosystem that supports each other. And it's a theme I'd like to talk about if we get into it a little bit. I think we are heavy investors in the United States. Most of our jobs are in the U.S., so it's a matter of exporting as a central part of our business model. And I'm very pleased to be part of this summit, given that that the theme seems to be some longer term as well as some shorter term ways to go about stimulating exports, because in 2011 and 12 we're going to need that kind of encouragement to get to where we need to go. So good to be here.
Craig Bentley. Bentley Systems is a privately held software company headquartered in Pennsylvania. Over 25 years we've grown from five brothers to now 2,700 colleagues in the world. We're the largest in the world that does software for infrastructure, which is everything we build to improve the planet. The bulk of our revenues, now 60%, are from outside the United States. The majority of our colleagues are outside the United States, but all of our 1,100 great jobs in the U.S. depend on continued and improved access to foreign markets. And of course, the software industry itself is a tremendous trade surplus generator for the U.S., and we rely on, and most of our growth will depend on, exports going forward.
Jeffrey Schott, I'm a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics here in Washington. Years ago, I was an official of the U.S. Treasury and a U.S. trade negotiator, where I spent some time in the distant past in the Tokyo round, knocking down foreign barriers to U.S. exports. So I've had some practical experience in that area, and realize there's a lot more we can and should be doing in that regard, for the reason Susan spelled out so well. And also, 30 years ago, there was a President's Export Council that used to meet quite often in this building to talk about things that were wrong abroad that we could fix to improve our ability to export, and things that were wrong at home that got in the way or made it more difficult. And so the topic of export disincentives has always been one of interest and one that might be the subject of further discussion today.
I'm Fred Smith, the chairman and CEO of FedEx. FedEx is a $38 billion company involved in transportation, logistics, and business services. We're heavily involved in the import-export trades of the United States and elsewhere around the world, primarily through our express company, our Federal Express, which is our biggest operating company. It's the largest all-cargo transport system in the world. We operate about 670 airplanes, 85,000 vehicles through all of our operating companies. We primarily move things, as I mentioned, by air. The significance of that is that most of the time, U.S. exports and imports are depicted on CNN or what have you as container ships and so forth. And we're also in that side of the business too, but the reality is that all of the high value added and the high technology trade moves by air. And it's only about 1.5% of the tonnage moved in international trade, but it's over 40% of the value. And if you take out agriculture and petroleum, it's the majority of international trade. So we certainly have a unique insight into the issue of our customers exporting from the United States, and hopefully we make a contribution to the conversation today.
Thanks, Bill.
My name is Larry Lindsay. Aside from being your predecessor by three, I am now a small business owner, much smaller, with a lot of zeros off your numbers, believe me. But one-third of our revenue comes from overseas. And I would like to add to something that Bob Iger mentioned, which is this is a better problem since I've been in government, which started 30 years ago. That's H-1B visa program. Intellectual capital is extremely mobile on this planet, and we are erecting barriers to it. You can start your business here, you can start your business somewhere else, and right now, government policy is to start your business somewhere else in the intellectual capital realm because it's very hard to bring in talented people to this country.
John Surma, CEO of United States Steel Corporation. We're about a $25 billion or so company, about 40% outside the U.S., majority inside the U.S., both employment, 20-some thousand people, and an investment. In our sector in the world, there's about 1.2 or 3 billion tons, which is a lot of steel made every year, and about 40% of it crosses a border. So we're a very trade-oriented sector. Our particular position in the U.S. typically is a net importer. That's changing with the overall position of the dollar, so we're very much orienting ourselves more towards an export position now, if we can. More importantly, a lot of our very best customers in the mining, equipment, agricultural, and industrial equipment markets, they're terrific customers, and they are themselves very important exporters. So if they're successful exporters, it's really good for us. So we're very much interested in trade flows, trade laws, trade enforcement, trade agreements, et cetera. But the general subject of trade in the world of steel has always been very important. So I'm glad to be here.
My name is Jim Hoffa. I'm president of the Teamsters Union. We have 1.4 million members. We have members in Puerto Rico and the United States. And we're a very general union. We think everybody as we're their truck drivers. We are, as I say, we're airline pilots to zookeepers. We do everything. We're at Walt Disney. We always say the Mickey Mouse is a Teamster. I mean, believe it or not. We do everything, but we have a chance to see the economy, and we are very much into manufacturing. And we have seen what's happened to this country, the fact of closing companies everywhere. It was interesting, the president talked about going to Allentown to see a bakery. Last year I was there in Reading, and we had 400 people working at a place called York Peppermint Patty. And it was owned by Hershey, and they closed down and moved to Mexico and laid off 300 people, and the people had been there in 30, 40 years seniority. Closed it down, lock, stock, and barrel, took all the equipment, put it on a train, and sent it to Mexico. And I think that crystallizes our problem. If we're going to talk about exports, we have to have something to export. We have to make something in this country. And what's happening in this country is we don't make anything here anymore, and almost all manufacturing is basically going offshore, disappearing for different reasons. So what we have to do is to have an economic policy. Every major country today, you know, Mexico, India, China, they have a policy. They have a trade policy that maximizes exports because they are export economies. That's where the money's at. Export to America, export to richer companies. And we do not have such a policy, and what we've got to do, and hopefully this forum will help crystallize on an idea, how do we have a trade policy where we make things here that can be exported?
I'm Fred Hochberg. I'm chairman and president of the Export-Import Bank of the United States. I've been in the job for 6 months. president referred to FDR. The bank was started in 1934 when FDR was president to help pull the country out of the recession in terms of creating jobs and sustaining jobs. And I'm happy to work side by side with Larry and also echo what Susan said, and that is, you know, we are now at 10% of GDP is exports. We were as high as 13% a year and a half ago. We still lag most of the, Germany leads at 45% of their GDP is exports. So we need to find ways. We're not going to be as much a consumer economy. And we help finance companies large and small. We do a lot of work with Boeing, but frankly, 90% of the financings we do are for small companies to export. And I think we left Raul out for the introduction.
My name is Raul Pedraza. I'm the founder and president of a company called Magno International. Think of us as the little FedEx with no assets. We have $450 million in sales. I started the company when I exited the United States Army by buying a truck in Miami, Florida, and have grown it into 1,100 employees with about $500 million in revenue all over the world. We do import, export, customs brokerage forwarding, so global logistics.
Here's a way maybe of focusing some focusing some part of our discussion. Everyone had a reason why exports were important to the economy. Look at the data, as you mentioned, exports as a share of GDP are down. One plausible aspiration would be to double the level of exports that the United States engages in over the next 5 years. That's probably an ambitious target, but it's less ambitious because they've been depressed from their previous peaks. I'd be interested in people's views as to what the most important thing that some actor could do, either government and public policy or the business community, could do towards the objective of doubling U.S. exports, or if people don't like that goal, suggest an alternative goal. But I've been around business people enough to know that what counts, what you count, counts. And so setting some kind of measurable goal, I think, is helpful, at least as a benchmark for our discussion. Bob, do you want to?
Well, I'd probably start at looking at the corporate tax rate, which might not be the easiest thing to accomplish now, but listening to what Jim was saying, it's interesting. We make a movie in the United States and export it successfully around the world, and we're paying 35% tax rate on that when we bring it back to the U.S. And to the point Larry made about our product being mobile, we could easily make that movie somewhere else in the United than the United States. House the intellectual property there. Ireland, a good example, paid 12.5% tax on the proceeds from that film. Again, because that business is so mobile. I think in our case, looking forward, there's just a lot more competition the United States is facing for business and jobs. And if we want to create growth for our company, one way to do it would be to reduce our tax rate by moving businesses outside, which wouldn't be that hard to do. It wouldn't be what we'd want to do, particularly for a U.S.-based company that's been around for 86 years, about 125,000 employees. But I think that's where I'd start. I haven't given that a significant amount of thought, that question, but it's definitely an issue for not just the Walt Disney Company, but for the whole television motion picture business and other businesses.
I'm going to suggest you say your name again, because people will be watching this on video, so that way, if they tune in late, they'll know exactly who you are.
My name is Bill Hossie from Midamar Corporation, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Thank you for the invitation. One of the things that I believe that we really need to reinforce is through the U.S. Department of Commerce's trade missions. We need to get over this idea that we are not welcomed overseas and it's an insecure world to travel in. As I said, I was born and raised in Iowa, went to the Peace Corps, supposed to go to law school, but my dad went crazy when I went to the Peace Corps instead, and went to Vietnam and Saudi Arabia, and over the last
35 years, we've built a company that has had virtually no U.S. government or state support, but we've had tremendous support through the Department of Commerce trade missions. And one of the best ways for us to get our profile back international is through trade missions throughout Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. These are some of the fastest growing areas. Our commodities, our quality product is still welcome. We still have an edge on many products in the world, and one of the challenges we have is what the gentleman mentioned about stop moving jobs overseas. There's U.S. companies that want to produce roast beef in Brazil and bring it back to our country. It's crazy. Maytag is a company that was in Iowa. All of you, I'm sure, have seen the Maytag man on TV. He's sitting there idle because he has a quality product. The company was bought by Whirlpool and promised not to close. Within a year, they closed it. And the same thing with Amana. We need trade missions to, in the agricultural sector, I think one of the biggest opportunities we still have globally, and virtually everybody in this room was hit last year without knowing it by the price, and you knew it at Disney, by the price of oils, mayonnaise. Every facility that used any type of agriculture had this shock of high prices. It helped the farmers, but it didn't help everybody else when soya went from $5 to $15, and corn likewise. But we have an opportunity to address this global strategic demand for food security. It's a growing problem, and we need to address it through trade.
Jim?
I'd mention a couple of things. One would be trade agreements. I think whenever we've done one, you tend to see a surplus. And I think there's a number that could be done. There's also Doha, and settling for half a loaf for some of us with Doha is better than holding out for something that may never happen. But I think that would give a lot of us a lot of confidence to invest in the technology and the infrastructure to for U.S.-based jobs exported overseas, give us some incremental growth. I also think credit to small businessmen, because I made the point that we're an aggregation of 22,000 small businesses that support us, a couple in this room actually, and they're going to have trouble during the ramp up, okay? Taking a longer view, 2011, 2012, after we get through sort of a stimulus-oriented pickup that may not last forever, to your point on demand, Larry, I think sort of getting that team ready to work with the systems integrators to become exporters themselves as part of our systems is a big deal. So supporting small business is not antithetical, rather symbiotic with the big business theme.
What does that mean? Does that mean more XM? Does that mean more SBA?
I think it means more, in my mind, it's more SBA-like support. It's more support for a small business that has been cutting inventory, because we've told them to, okay? And then all of a sudden, they're going to have to come back quickly, and the big financial institutions may have not been there in every case to support that. So I think that would help this team that I need to have with me, or if one of the 4 million parts out of 777 isn't ready to go, I can't ship the 777.
To build on that and then add to on the small business, our larger clients, some of our largest clients are small business. People and the access to credit is choking them, and therefore having a very big impact on us. We have gone as far, Xerox has gone as far as to set up its own credit facilities to try to fund some of our clients to be able to actually do business. Now, this is not the business that we really want to be in, but we have to have this cycle going such that we can actually assure that we can keep our company going. So having an infrastructure in the country that is actually positive for investment, so that's either access to credit or a tax structure that's logical and predictable, at least, one that incents investments in research and development, is one whole side of it, and I think that's part of what we said. The other side is the longer-term view that I just can't pass up on. I'm Ursula Burns, Xerox Corporation, and CEO. And that's assuring that we have talented people in this country to do work. And this is a huge deal, because part of what I think, I'm not sure who said it, we have to import talent to do work, and when we can't do that, because it's very difficult to do, we export the work to the talent. So we have to have a way to actually incent young people to get engaged. And by the way, they can be young or middle-aged, it doesn't matter, but people engaged in tough areas of study that actually we can create jobs in this country. Because all we'll do is search for the work and for the talent other places, so.
You know, Ethan Allen, we have been one of the, a major employer in the northeast of Vermont, which has, all of that area has been drastically impacted with people losing their jobs. So I had a session a year back with the governor and some others there, and we were discussing, and I said if Vermont was independent, you would export to the other states. I think we've got to work towards making sure that we are able to export our products from Vermont to other states and from North Carolina to California. If you're not able to do that, it's hard for us to ship it to Europe or to China. Now, our industry, you know, we're in the furniture industry, is somewhat labor intensive, and in the last 15 years, 70% of the manufacturing has moved overseas. And the reasons are that, you know, they've got newer plants. 25 years back, it was a cottage industry in China and Vietnam. Today, they have better technology than us. They have a lower labor cost. They have lower taxes. They have export incentives. They have availability of credit. They have less government regulations. They have lower health costs. And they don't have excessive litigation. Now, these are all the issues that are impacting us. So I believe that we have been able to maintain our manufacturing in the United States, as I said, and then export is because we have done a major consolidation of our manufacturing in the United States. We have also invested a great deal in technology. We have also done something that, you know, is hard to do. As a public company, you've got to provide technically the best shareholder value, which means, as your finance people will tell you, to close all the plants and move them overseas. But we have said that we are going to balance our margins between what we do overseas and what we do domestically. For instance, we have established a major plant in North Carolina and consolidated in the last since the tsunami hit us, we consolidated two major plants into North Carolina, but we also established a plant in Mexico, in central Mexico. The combination of central Mexico making parts for us, which are labor intensive, hard to make here, has made it possible for us to be competitive in the United States and export our finished products overseas. So I think today we've got to be able to see that we have the ability to give these incentives at the local level, at the national level, to be able to be competitive in the United States. Otherwise, the only thing we're going to be exporting is, you know, some of these high-tech products and aircrafts and others. Otherwise, in my view, we've got to reduce imports. But if we're able to make more products for our consumers here, we're going to create jobs. To me, that is a tremendous amount of opportunity right across the board.
Just maybe to follow up on that, John Sermon again from USCO. I don't know if this is in bounds or not, Larry and Fred, but the overall currency realignment really changes the export value model for us. And when I'm looking at netting back to a plant when it's a 150 euro, it's a whole lot different than when it's a 110 euro like it was 3 or 4 years ago. So that's a huge difference. And that's very favorable from our standpoint now, obviously. And I'm not expecting you to comment on that aspect of it. It's determined in the marketplace, whatever it is. But with respect to China, of course, as the President stated pretty clearly, I thought, in a recent visit, that alignment is not determined in the marketplace. And having some progress on rebalancing that situation, because that distorts the currency and trade flows in that part of the world and even into Europe. So I think that would be hugely important and would give a lot of us a far greater opportunity to be competitive in a broader array of markets, and would also tend to allow U.S. companies to have greater share of our markets as demand comes back, if we would have a somewhat more rebalanced both currency, which I think would then lead to rebalanced trade relationship with China.
So what's constructively actionable for us now in software also has to do with China. But just to back up, wouldn't we like to export software, something that doesn't consume any natural resources here or generate any waste, but of course it's a global economic structure where we can amortize our fixed costs of development across global markets. There's another knock-on advantage. Well, back up. To double our exports and our net exports in software is something we wouldn't shrink from expecting and being able. Our net trade surplus in software was $36 billion in 2008, and that was up like 9% over the year before, and we're sure of being able to increase it going forward, provided the markets are open. And I might say, when we export innovation in the form of American software, we can help Americans be more competitive, for instance, to do work as our software does that allows plants and roadways and high-speed rail to be virtually simulated before it's built and analyzed and so forth. We can be better at having Americans adopt that technology faster and get more share of that infrastructure work in the world at large. But there's no such greater piece of work than the infrastructure investment that China is making now, and our company is well prepared to take advantage of that with our investment in China. In China to date, we've even done acquisitions there. But in software, we have an urgent issue at the moment. Just last month, the Chinese government propagated indigenous innovation initiative, which we only learned about this week in software, and it would give preference in government procurement to Chinese technology, not only in software and computers and telecom equipment and energy equipment and high efficiency devices. We've got to get applications in by a week from today, and there'll be a list by the end of this month that will create a mandate to disadvantage American products in the Chinese marketplace. I know President Obama began, I think, this work with his Asia trip, and we're confident that we can, if he'll apply our government weight to this, help counteract that offset to what is our largest opportunity anywhere, and with which we can be sure of creating and maintaining better green jobs in the U.S.
Jeff, say something about the potential magnitude of the impact of trade agreements on demand for U.S. exports or U.S. employment.
Well, I think one of the things you have to think about is our market's pretty old already. And so what we're doing in a trade negotiation is really trying to level the playing field. The agreement that got China into the WTO was essentially we didn't change our policies and they reduced their barriers quite a lot. Did it create a lot of new opportunities compared to the very limited space we had before? Yes. But what I think is more important is what was said before. When you have better access, it sends a signal for investment that the business can then take advantage. And I think when one talks about trade agreements, it's too often saying the difference in tariffs when really the signal of opportunities for investors to build here and expand their production to take advantage of new opportunities abroad. And there the price is important, and the comment John made on the exchange rate is exactly right. Asia is where where there's a problem now. The U.S. dollar is getting close to, I'd say, an equilibrium level. You know it better than I. But the source of undervaluation is among the Asian countries. They need to appreciate, and that will help the access to or create new sales opportunities in the part of the world economy that's rapidly growing.
Larry, let me ask you your question about doubling exports, which is the right kind of goal, but many economies are growing rapidly: Brazil, India, Colombia, Vietnam, many, not just the BRICS. The question is how we would actually help American companies meet that brutal competition, because it's very tough competition. Jim certainly sees that. You see that around the world. So in addition to what we do here, what could we do to help American companies compete better? Because it's very tough out there.
I'm Jim Hoffa of the Teamsters. I think the question that Larry posed, you know, what can government do? I think the answer is one of the problems is the trade policy. We've had a bad trade policy you know, going back to Clinton, going back to Bush, of basically opening up our markets to closed markets. You know, as we say, NAFTA, CAFTA, and the workers got the shafta. And that's what's happened. We've seen thousands and thousands of jobs, plants closed, because we can't penetrate their markets, but they come here. We see the inflow of Chinese products. We see, you know, tremendous trade deficits with Mexico, India, and China. Why? Because of a bad trade policy. If this government wants to do something, enforce the trade laws as we have them, enforce 301 with a U.S. Trade representative, like the tire case that the steel workers brought. Those are the things we should do that are affirmative. And the other thing is, stop pushing a bill like the Korea Trade Agreement that doesn't do enough to open that economy. Everybody knows that one of the biggest things there is agricultural goods. It opens it a little bit. We still can't get our beef in. We can't get our cars in. Only 4,000 cars went there. We know what Hyundai and everybody else are flooding our markets with their cars, and yet it's not reciprocal. And the same thing with Japan is a very closed economy. And let's face it, they're getting the best. We made bad deals. And now everybody's saying, well, how come all of our plants are closing? And they're, all we see is nothing but imports. If you're going to export, you have to open markets. And trade policy should be to open markets. And this government and the past administrations have failed miserably on WTO, on NAFTA, and all these agreements. We've got to change our policy. We got to think America first if we're going to make sure we have businesses going to this country.
Susan Collins from the Ford School at the University of Michigan. You had asked about how we might actually achieve doubling of our export. If you go back and look before the crisis, U.S. exports were gradually growing. Part of that was related to relative prices and exchange rate issues. Part of it was also related to an expansion in the range within particular industries of which firms were actually going abroad. That's a somewhat gradual process, but if you're actually going to change a process in which for something like the past 10 years, on average, exports as a share of US GDP had fluctuated but really had not had a trend increase, there has to be in some ways a broader change in the kind of how deep down within particular industries and firms there's a connection and an attempt to go abroad. So there was a discussion about the wide range of benefits, not just in terms of the details of how a trade agreement with another country works, but also the kind of demonstration and broader impact effect. There are the credit issues that are related to the fact that our production is more divided up, and so there's more integration among the small firms and the bigger firms. So trying to understand, I think as Jeff was saying, where the impediments are. But basically, it has to be, in some ways, a sea change that changes the range of firms here, because the competition is harder. And a lot of other countries, there's a larger percentage of the firms in a given industry who are going abroad than is true in this country. So it's changing that atmosphere, I think, that would really make a longer-term difference.
One of the policies is what you specifically mentioned, and it's a tough issue on visas. One of the ways we can expand international trade is opening up visas. Every year there's a number of trade shows throughout the United States, but the largest industry show for food and equipment is every year in Chicago. It's called the National Restaurant Association Show. In the past, starting in the 90s, with our company, we decided to take and set aside so much of a budget, and we would select somebody from Singapore, somebody from Saudi Arabia, somebody from Malaysia, somebody from Egypt. We would pay their way to come to Chicago. We'd pay their airplane ticket and their hotel and let them spend 5 days in Chicago at the National Restaurant Association. Not only for our company, we'd take them to the beef plants, the food plants, and we would generally bring about 10 to 12 people. People said, well, that's a big investment. I said, but you know what it costs us to go to a trade show overseas? We will defer a trade show a year and invest in bringing people to the States. In the last few years, we have not had any visitors from Malaysia or Indonesia or Saudi Arabia or Egypt. Last year, one of the biggest food operators in Saudi Arabia wanted to bring his wife and three children they would not give visas for his children because they're all under 15. And we say, how can we expand trade? We need a visa re-evaluation program. And secondly, we are actually FedEx's largest customer in Iowa. We have 3 to 4 trucks every day at FedEx.
We genuflected every shipment too, I can tell you that much. We appreciate the
business. Well, thank you, because you get our products to all 50 states and a number of countries. But my second point is, we need to think about how to restructure the mental idea of job recreation of employment, because everybody cannot go back to a community college and learn an academic skill. I had a good friend that was laid off from a meat plant, and he came to me practically in tears and said, Bill, he says, hell, you know I could hardly get through school. And he says, I've been cutting beef for the last 30 years. They want to send me back to Kirkwood to learn computers. What the hell am I going to do at Kirkwood? He says, I only hardly read the paper every day. Now, we have a certain sector of good, hardworking people in this country, but they're not going to go back to a community college. I told Chuck, I said, well, come out, we'll find something. But we have to change this attitude that you cannot send everybody back to learn computers, and they don't want to go work at McDonald's or Burger King. I'm not picking on those food because we supply them. But we have to change a mindset where we have good workers that are creative and functional, because you cannot take somebody that's been in a certain type of job and say, you're going back when you're 50 years old and learn how to run computers or do bookkeeping. So there's a certain mindset. I have a later idea for U.S. I have a later idea for U.S. Steel, but and it's something I thought about a long time. But we need to work.
Need all the help I can get.
Pardon?
I need all the ideas I can. Whatever you have, I'm glad to hear them.
Okay, well, I'll let some of the others talk, but we need to expand international trade both ways, opening up visas to bring people here, and again, the trade missions to get people overseas. We are welcome. The largest food chains, I don't care, Applebee's, Chili's, McDonald's, Burger King, KFC, they're all over the world. And in these countries that we talk about are unstable or they hate us, they don't. They're full. And our equipment is good, our services are good, and as they say, I started with no money after the Peace Corps and after Vietnam, and now thankfully we export to about 35 countries. We've exported several hundred million dollars in food products, and we can do it. We just need to get over this hurdle that, you know, everything is imposed against the U.S. It's not.
I think Fred wanted to say something.
Well, my view on this matter is that you have to look at exports as a subset of industry in general. And I'm old enough to remember when the business magazines and the reporting used to be divided into industry and finance. And finance was viewed as a facilitating activity and not a primary function. Now, in 1983, finance constituted about 15% of the profits of all American industry. In 2007, it was almost 35%. So the question is, why have we migrated into this financial services rather than manufacturing things for the American market and for the export market? In my opinion, the biggest reason is the tax policies of the United States favor financial services, which has morphed into financial speculation because of the regulatory changes and the globalization of financial markets. And as long as you have a tax rate of 38%, which is basically what we pay, and that 38% can be mitigated by the deductibility of interest, if you want to go into the private equity business or you want to go into the financial services business, the federal government is subsidizing to the extent of 38 cents on the dollar. So not only do you have that factor, it is non-competitive, as Bob said, versus the worldwide situation. So our corporate tax rate is simply not competitive, and much more importantly, it advantages financial services at the expense of industry. The second thing that I would say which is extremely important, you should permit industrial companies, for that matter, I guess any entity, to expense capital equipment and software when it's put into service. When we buy one of these magnificent 777s from Boeing, it's a very big expenditure of money. We get that money back over a 7-year period of time based on the depreciation schedules that we can use. So when times get bad, every boardroom in America hears the same mantra. Slow CapEx down. Push it off. Make do. Even when the technology, like a 777 versus the airplane that it replaces in our fleet, could be made independent of the financial cycle because it has a high ROI. And every time we get one of those big 777s, there are machinists making those big GE engines in Ohio and Massachusetts and parts and pieces in Washington State and so forth. And what would happen if you allowed the expensing of capital equipment and software is you change the risk assessment at the boardroom level. The net cost to the government is the time value of the money, and that assumes that the investment was going to be made in a down cycle under any circumstance, and that's not true because it is pushed off. So I think if you recognize that the corporate tax rate disadvantages industry and advantages financial services and speculation, and the treatment of capital investment versus the deductibility of interest for private equity or other things, you have to solve those problems first. Then, you know, I've watched this now for 30-some-odd years. I agree with Mr. Hoffa on this. Basically, what happened is the United States opened our markets after World War II to rebuild Europe and Japan. And we fought the Cold War largely on that basis, that we would open up our market and make people rich. And then we did it for China, as we were talking about. And that's a wonderful thing that we've helped drag 700 million Chinese citizens out of poverty. The problem is that people around the world that trade with us operate on a mercantilistic basis. And we've seen that at FedEx many times, where we have an aviation agreement and the other side, in fact we have one going on right now, decides they want to individually abrogate that and starts taking advantage of us. And I have to tell you, it is very difficult to get the United States government to stand up and enforce our trade rights. And
exactly right.
That has gone on for a long, long time. So in many other sectors, that is also the case. Now, there are a lot of other contributing things that have been said here that I agree with. You've got to get let intellectual property into this country. It's ridiculous. We're a country of immigrants. You've got to have research and development. It's silly to, you know, not have the investment tax credit for that. But in my opinion, you got to have trade assistance adjustment for people when they lose their jobs to keep the political support for trade. But if you don't change the corporate tax rate, if you don't allow equipment and software to be expensed, and if you don't insist that we have open markets, you can't, in my opinion, be competitive in the export sector.
Larry wants to say something.
Yes, one thing I know you can't do in your current job, but I've been able to, is actually, this gets to what a lot of people said, is actually visit a U.S. embassy, not as a government official. I've done a lot as a government official. It's very different when you're not a government official. And I think it's a tough reform, and others have tried it, but it goes to foreign service rules and everything else. The people who staff those embassies are rotated, meaning they don't get delved deep into the society to be able to help the people in the street when they come by. They are not user-friendly in general. Getting into the embassy is not a user-friendly procedure. So whether you're talking about the trade missions, whether you're talking about the visa process or whatever, you do have to do something on what our embassies do and the attitude of the people at the embassies toward real people as opposed to government officials. put Larry on your math, it's going to be very difficult to do what you want if you're also adding 4% of GDP to government and 1% of GDP to health care. The numbers just don't work.
Mr. Summers, on his point about the embassies and commerce need more. I know where our budgets are strained, but last year in Malaysia, we're a small company in Iowa, but the ATO and Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, did not have the funds to support the 4th of July annual dinner that they normally have. Now, I'm not boasting, but here's a small company. We provided all of the prime ribs and all of the turkey to the Marriott Hotel for them to have the 4th of July, so they didn't end up with, and it's an Islamic country, so they didn't end up with fruit juice and little appetizers for the 4th of July function. Our embassies and ATO missions are underfunded. And as you said, unless you know somebody that's going to meet you at the gate and call ahead, it's hell to get into the embassies. They have all these, and we've built this siege mentality around our embassies and in countries that are still friendly to us. So we need to change this by, again, I'll mention it the second or third time, we need to be sending trade missions to say, here we are, and we're here in a trade, open attitude, we're friends, and we're coming here, and we're coming here, and we're coming here.
Your question was an interesting one that I've been thinking about. So if I wanted to do more business in Vietnam or whatever, what would I have to do? It's competitive out there, what would I have to do? So the first thought is that you have to have something that someone wants to buy. That's right. What companies do, right? We figure out this interesting thing that somebody wants to buy. And interestingly enough, that thought can happen anywhere. For Xerox, a lot of it happens in the United States, but it could happen anywhere. Then you have to be able to translate that thought into something and make it. It's software, it could be a plane, it could be a movie. You have to make it in a way that actually is of reasonable quality. And then you have to have that quality be made at a price that's reasonable. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be the cheapest price, one of the things that we've learned. It doesn't have to be the least expensive, absolutely, but it has to be reasonably expensive. Inexpensive or reasonably competitive. And then you have to be able to get it to the consumer. And then fair markets take over. So what we do is we do the first three things pretty well. We can think of an idea. We can figure out a way to make it. We get a reasonable cost, either by doing it here or by importing things that are done other places and doing it, whatever it is to make it. And then we need help. This is back to the conversation that you were having, Fred, and everybody. That's when we need help. And we get less help than I think other countries' governments provide than ours do. Because we don't need help in the idea. We don't need help in the actual research. We need help in having a reasonable chance of our great idea being competitively positioned in the markets outside of this country. We need tax rates this is not freedom. We just need a reasonable chance of having this reasonably good idea being competitively positioned in another marketplace. And after we do the first three steps, we have more energy fighting through to get this reasonably good idea positioned competitively outside the country than I think other people do. We're getting it done here, or other people do.
And when you say reasonably positioned, what does that mean?
One of the things I used to think when I was growing up as an engineer is that it has to be the absolute cheapest thing in the world. Reasonably positioned means it has to be reasonably differentiated.
But it has to have value.
It has to have value. It has to have
price. He does not sell the cheapest plane.
Right, he's not selling the cheapest plane. But I tell you what.
Well, I can tell you that.
Fortunately, I don't buy them. But it has to be reasonably positioned. And I think that if you add up all of the things back to Larry's start of what's the one thing, unfortunately, there is not one thing. There is just so many things that we have to fight through as business to get the output, these first three steps of this reasonably good idea, made at a reasonable quality with a reasonable price. After that's done, that's just the very, very beginning of getting it positioned anywhere, even in this country, but forget about outside
the
country.
So is it the embassy's not helping with
sales?
It's not
only that, it's standards. I mean, if you look at its standard, for example, we actually have ecological standards placed on the equipment that we ship into countries. You look at the standards, they're different all over the place. they're significantly harder and advantage to the countries, to the country's indigenous people than it ours. Everything works against. There's a whole wall built around.
You're saying you're saying that, and a number of you have said this in different ways, that you're capable of generating a reasonable value proposition for customers.
I am absolutely.
But you are not capable of getting the value proposition put to customers on a level playing
level
field
playing
basis
field
as pervasively as you would like.
Right, and consistently
around the world. And what Jim tends to stress, which is also part of what you all have said, is that we in the United States allow foreign companies to put their value proposition before our consumers in a fairer minded, in a basically more level playing field way than often happens for our producers abroad.
A perfect example of that. The biggest non-tariff barrier in the world today that's used by many, many companies as a mercantilistic tactic, either by design or by historical accident, are the customs clearance.
Customs clearance.
We've worked very hard over the years to modernize our customs procedures using information in advance to make our borders frictionless and so forth. And you go into certain countries around the world, and this is particularly injurious to high-tech products and pieces. That
what it's classified as,
yeah,
and what the tariff is, if it's classified
sure,
one way versus another
way. They'll slow them down and make it difficult to get that equipment into that country because it competes with a product that's produced in that country. And that goes on all over the world, and it is a small thing to our foreign service, which is mostly focused on geopolitical issues and not on commercial and trade issues.
Well, one thing we do stop well at our borders is the people we need coming in.
Or customers coming in.
Customers coming in as well.
I just want to kind of back a bunch of people's play here as the small guy at the table and the smallest company. Secretary Solis this morning spoke about the level of unemployment in the minority communities being double what they are in the other communities, and that's entirely true. And the big part is the access to capital that James brought up. Had I not had a lot of personal wealth, I would have had to lay off probably 20% of my staff through this last recession, because believe me, I mean, it was like the well was dry. And it was amazing to me because I'd always been able to walk into my local banker and they know me and I know them and I've been so successful and everything's good, and all of a sudden, no, it's not good anymore. And so that the access to capital is a big thing. But also, the customs clearance thing is, you made me think of the blue ink. Brazil, if the document isn't in blue ink, because you know, if it was in black ink, it could be a copy. You know, then all of a sudden, Apple Computer, who's one of my big customers, and I know you too, they get double the tariff hit on because you have to have this whole staff just to set up to the blue ink thing, and so that's definitely a barrier. And anyway, in my company, 63% of my employees are minorities. So if we enforce the set asides and everything, and I congratulated and thanked Mr. Smith on the way up here because I know he's a billion-dollar roundtable member. So I know he's on it and everything else, but the smaller guys need the access to the capital, and then we can go out and get more people.
You're talking about your diversity council.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, just to weigh in briefly, I think Fred's point on a tax policy that makes sense and supports innovation is really what it adds up to. You know, we are competing against players in other countries that not only have that, but a lot more in support of them. I mean, I cite the recent WTO example we're fighting through, and I don't want to get parochial, but the facts are there is a hell of a lot of support for Airbus airplanes that go far beyond what Fred is talking about. And ECA kinds of support that are different than the kind of support that you're allowed to give us because we haven't got the right bilateral agreement, then there's the customs. Larry, to your point, there's a host of things. And I just want to just drag back the tax policy is something that supports the differentiation you need to have the comparative advantage you want to compete globally. And I just want to make sure that that doesn't get lost in the facilitation kinds of ideas.
We also have a tremendous disadvantage on because of our tax structure. Because in the GATT agreements, value-added taxes are you can remove them at the border on exports, but the way our tax structure is, our taxes are embedded in our export and our attempt. What they call that was ruled by the WTO, the foreign investment. It was ruled to be an illegal trade subsidy simply because we'd been out negotiated years ago by the Europeans where they can take their VAT out of their exports and our taxes have to ride in our landed cost product.
I want to call on Paul Krugman who came in late and is a Nobel Prize winning international economist. Do you want to share a perspective on this competitiveness question? Should the country be trying to raise exports substantially? Can it raise exports substantially? What's most important? What's your reaction to some of the things you've heard?
Well, I'm learning a lot. So this is stuff I don't think about much. I guess I would say that this all bears on. Historically, the United States has always seemed to be, its export performance falls short of what you would have expected given productivity, given relative labor costs, and so on. So, and that's, you know, there are multiple causes, right? Part of some of that may be cultural, but that we face, not people in this table, but a lot of people in this country just don't sort of believe the rest of the world exists. But but there is something persistent that it has. I guess I've been thinking about this most recently, mainly from just a macroeconomic perspective, we will get some more competitive value of the dollar is going to help quite a lot. On the eve of this crisis, we were actually having a pretty significant export expansion, and then we were running into problems, some of which came up here. The skill shortages we were suffering were not quantum physicists, they were machinists. We might want to think longer term about shouldn't our education system be producing skills that are less academic, and some of our competitors do that. There's a really big issue, I don't know whether anybody want to take on this room, which is macro policies. Quite apart from these trade things we're talking about, we have a number of countries, China most importantly, but others, which are essentially running artificially undervalued currencies, running persistent sort of excessive trade surpluses as a matter of policy, and that's going to be part of the story. I'm thinking of myself mainly as a listener and hearing business stories that I don't want to normally.
Thanks very much.
Larry, this is, we have had a crisis in the last year, unparalleled, and a crisis creates an opportunity. And the opportunity is really reinventing our ability to manufacture here. And now I think that we have that attitude. I think in the businesses that are going to survive, they're going to have this attitude of reinvention. They're going to have an attitude of making major changes because America needs to be reinvented. And this crisis is helping us. And I'm not talking of just the major companies that we hear here, which really have been doing a great job. I'm talking of thousands and hundreds of thousands of smaller enterprises like ours, which have to reinvent. And I think it's a great, great opportunity for the government to see, to take this opportunity to help companies of smaller companies of our size, smaller manufacturers. You know, we also happen to be vertically integrated. We run retail also. Now, we are very easy for us to go and overseas and do everything from overseas. In fact, our industry is doing it. But I think this unique opportunity should not be lost because, as I said, there is this mood of reinvention, and this reinvention help from government, whether it's in all the things we're talking about, whether it is to help us get technology, help us train our people, get credit, help us make it easier to do business here and elsewhere. I think this is a unique opportunity, and we can do what you were just saying, that is doubling it, because the opportunity is there today in the country.
In response to your question about trade agreements, I'm not sure we heard from the viewpoint of that those sectors that have been successful in exports and are driving good jobs here. Trade agreements are not just about tariffs, but also give us a chance to negotiate other terms, and I know Bob referred to intellectual property earlier. It's our experience in software that where we have engaged in trade treaties, we have created markets that respect intellectual property around the world, and in general, we get the same price elsewhere in the world as in the United States now for software and for other intellectual property. So it's been a real success there, and to the concern about job loss as a result of engagement, you might, I suppose, some might think that it might not be, that it wouldn't be possible for a software company to export successfully to India. Well, among our 2,700 folks in the world, we have several hundred people in India, and of course they're doing some software development, but we are a net exporter to India by about a factor of 3 or 4, because of course their needs are for infrastructure development and tools and technology and innovation for that we can provide to our software market here. So I'm sure that trade agreements net contribute positively to our ability to double and continue to double exports.
John?
Good job.
Oh,
go ahead.
Well, we're talking about, you know, how does the government help? That's what we want. How does the government help? I mean, everybody else here is doing their part, but how does the government help? I think the government has to change the way they think about trade. We're seeing something, you know, unique now. You see the dollar dropping, you know, versus world currencies, but we don't see the trade balances change. You know, under basic economic laws, there should be a change, but it just shows you the extent of the trade barriers we're up against. You know, that even though the dollar, our exports should be cheaper, and yet it's not making an impact on any of the numbers across the board, which is really, you know, an indication of the amount of the battle we face. The other thing that I think really bothers me that I think that could help exports and American jobs, and I think when you talk about exports, you have to talk about American jobs and American exports, is the fact that the government does not think Buy America. When you go to China, they think about Buy Chinese. They are all about Chinese nationalism. They are about the Chinese economy. That's all they care about. They want to buy Chinese. You want to do business there, you build a plant there. That's the way they are, the Japanese, the Koreans, everybody. They put their countries first. We don't do that. And the best example is when we get into competition, we get into procurement. The Pentagon could do so much more than what they're doing by fostering and make sure we buy more American products. And that will create, you know, more and stimulate the economy here, put more people to work. The Airbus tanker deal with regard to Boeing was probably the best example that went through the whole thing that eventually got stopped. The whole deal there was, when the Pentagon did that, the one thing that they did not, they were asked by Congress, did you consider the impact on American jobs? And they said no. That should have been the number one thing they thought about. And they did not even consider it when they did that bidding. And the same thing when you talk about Marine One, the Sikorsky helicopter for the president. It was a time that, you know, the Pentagon wanted to do the berets for our soldiers. They wanted to do them in China. And that's what's wrong with the thinking of the government, that they've got to think America first. If we're going to have and be serious about creating jobs and, you know, putting people back to work, we better start thinking about Buy America, let's put Americans to work, and then you've got a product, whether it's the tanker, that we will go and sell as an export around the world, because America is using that as their tanker, and whether it's the Sikorsky helicopter that's the next model for the president or whatever. That's how you create products, and you have the stimulation of the Pentagon doing it and buying for the procurement and making, you know, that product.
Mr. Sumner?
Jeff.
Well, I might take a slightly different view. Not that I don't want to expand the opportunities for production and sales by U.S. firms, both in the U.S. market and abroad, but I'm worried that the economic environment in which Buy American provisions now operate is totally different from when the laws were originally introduced. And what we have seen is that firms have a very hard time finding products that fully fit a 100% American content requirement. And the stimulus package, part of the reason some of the projects have not gone forward is because the tendering process has gotten all bollocked up. So instead of meeting the good intentions of hiring more American workers in American plants,
we've ended up with resources being unused and projects not being done. And we have to be very concerned about fitting the regulations and the intent and providing the subsidies in a way that encourages job creation without stopping the production from taking place.
I think John wanted to say something.
Just to get at your earlier question about what the government can do to help, I think you all ought to recognize that there could be things you do that wouldn't help as well. You know, manufacturing in the U.S., it's a wonderful country. We've got great freedoms and abundant resources, great workforce, many great things to be manufactured here that I'm very pleased to be leading a company that does. But there's also a cost burden that we all have that many of our competing countries don't that we're in the marketplace with. If we move forward on something like cap and trade, okay, maybe we have to do that. But we need to recognize that for those companies that have products that are energy intensive, we're going to have a cost that our competitors aren't. And if that's what our government chooses to do, that's okay, but that would be a step that would make us less competitive. And because, even around this table, you can see it, virtually every company that operates in the U.S. is more efficient from a carbon intensity standpoint than virtually every other company in every other country in the world. The paradox is that if we impose that and suppress domestic production, we increase global emissions. And that seems like a policy. Increase domestic unemployment, reduce domestic employment, increase global emissions. That doesn't seem like a real winning strategy to me. So I just keep that on your list of things that could be harmful if it's not perceived properly.
I mentioned earlier that for U.S. Steel, it's something I've thought about a lot. Every day when I drive to work, I see this. They used to call them junkyards. Now they call them salvage yards or whatever. When they had the cash for clunkers, they made them put a solution in the engine block so the engine block couldn't be sold. And I've talked to the management at Sunline Van Dyke. With computer systems today, we can build cars, we can assemble cars, we can assemble vehicles. My thought is for U.S. Steel, why we cannot disassemble cars. And I talked to Secretary of Commerce Locke this morning. He said, we would like to have a program that is nationwide, that people can see that we're doing something nationwide. All over the country, there are called junkyards, salvage yards, whatever you want. U.S. Steel builds steel buildings. If we had long warehouses and you put a junker car, call it what you want, and just like an assembly line, which you disassemble, some of the hardest steel out there are the lug bolts and the tires. We're going all over the world to find copper, chrome, steel, iron ore, and we have, you're in the industry, you know how many millions of tons of old tractors and trucks are laying around the country. And my thought is to have long corridor warehouses. They're very basic, OSHA compliant, but how many different types of instruments would we buy and revive the industry to pull bolts out? Big suction plates would snap on a window and pull them out and put them into a recycle bin. The engines that can be reused with the computer knowledge we have today, you can have warehouses and stack an engine up for a Chevy, a Buick, a Toyota, whatever you want, and put it on an inventory basis. The rest goes back to your company for recycling. We have million, and this is a type of labor-intensive, not a high-trained, I don't mean to demean anybody's work skills, but we're talking about putting people back to work, like you were talking, Mr. Hoffman, where you can tell people, here, you're going to come in the morning and you're going to pull out the lugs, you're going to pull the tires, you're going to pull the glass, you're going to put the copper radiators in this line, and recycle this. We have a tremendous inventory of metals and tires and glass and lead and batteries sitting around this country just accumulating, and we need to help that, and I'm not in that industry.
But I'm just looking at, we got a signal, we got about 10 minutes.
Okay,
so.
Well, quickly, this is something for you to follow, but have a program where the government would help build warehousing to disassemble cars, have our resources here.
Larry, I think we've heard about intellectual property, we've heard about visas, we've heard about taxes. We've heard a lot about taxes. but there's got to be other things. I mean, you know, from where I sit at the Export-Import Bank, we are still the largest manufacturer in the world. We are the largest manufacturer in the world. And based on GDP ratios, we are 15 out of 15 in terms of what we export. So I think the issue is not so much importing, but it is exporting. We have the goods here. We're making the goods here. We're making equipment here from Boeing aircraft to turbines to farm equipment to construction equipment to medical equipment. It's a question of exporting. It's a question of meeting those markets.
Let me jump in then. I forget what the number exactly is, but a small amount of companies are doing a lot of the exports. 2% of the companies are doing 70% of the exports. I've tried to make the case that many of us are an ecosystem including a lot of small companies, okay? And so we hate the politics of either support small companies or big companies. Big companies aren't very popular right now, so let's support small companies. Yeah, no. And so that's where I get back to Fred's comment, which is something that admittedly gets at big companies, investment tax credits, R&D tax credits, right. Change to a tax system. But these big companies, I got 22,000 suppliers. I have 175,000 Boeing jobs, 290,000 supplier jobs, and then another 900,000 support jobs that support the supplier base. That's a 1.3 million. So you're supporting every time there's a policy that does what Fred says, it has as much support on small companies as it does big ones. And on top of that, I am supportive of more credit in particular to facilitate the growth of the small companies. But it's that. So the point is, supporting big companies is good if you want to meet Larry's objective. That's point one. 1% or 2% of the companies are doing 70% of the exports. And secondly, let's turn it into support an ecosystem of big and small together.
But Fred, you're saying, why are people not buying our products?
We don't have that.
You're saying, well, we're making products and not selling them. Well, the answer is, it's the trade barriers. You know, why are we not selling cars, in South Korea? Why are we not being able to penetrate the Japanese market? Why can't we still steal in the, you know, I answer your question for you. Trade barriers. It's not really hard to figure out. It's rather simple. We have the products. Our products are much cheaper now because of the drop in the dollar, but yet we are not selling them. And it's still, I mean, you guys are all in business. You're all trying to penetrate these markets. Everybody here on this table is trying to get into those markets, and they know more than I do how hard it is because of whether it's, you know, at the border or whatever. They don't want you in there. Or if you do go in there, they're going to make you pay such a price. You have to give up your intellectual property. You've got to do this. You've got to build a factory. You've got to do this. That's what the problem is. So I'll answer your question for you. You can't get in because they don't want to let you in.
If I could just add, it's interesting that I'm actually agreeing with you, Mr. Hoffman. But because your question is an interesting one, which is, so I heard all the stuff, there must be something more. There's not much more.
That's it.
I mean, really.
Pretty simple.
I've been CEO since July 1st, and I walked into this job figuring, this is easy. You make something that people want, you make it good, and you sell it to them. So you do that, and you walk it to a border, and you say, here it is, and they say, well, I have one pretty much like it. Or your thing didn't meet these set of rules that it should have met. It should have been had blue ink on it, or it should have been categorized as a printer, not as a copier. We're going to put this tariff on it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's one. We have costs that other countries just don't have. Because they don't have the same regulations that we have. They cover them some other way. They have currency. It's not rocket science. It's not easy to solve. But there's not some hidden thing here that says, well, there must be another solution. I think it's pretty simple. We actually do make, I think we make very, very good things. And I think in an open market, just if you laid them on the floor, they would buy my stuff more than they would buy other people's stuff. But they don't.
Sir, one quick point on Japan, why we can't open Japan on automobiles. They drive on the opposite side, and they're all metric. And we don't have any manufacturers in the United States. I've talked about this for 30 years since I was in Africa and the Middle East. We don't have one U.S. company that will manufacture an international car where the driving is on the right-hand side and metric. Where are you going to take the U.S. car in Japan and have it repaired? You're going to take a 11-centimeter bolt and tell them I want a 7/16 wrench? We have not penetrated the Japanese auto industry because they use the British system both on driving and metric system. So part of our responsibility is if we want to take one auto manufacturing plant and say, this is going to be a cost competitive plant that's going to produce a metric right-hand column, then we can penetrate some of these markets. But
We cannot say they won't let us in when we're producing a car that's opposite of their industry standards. That's the reality.
I'm going to try to do a brave thing and summarize what I think I've learned.
It's in your name.
What I think I have learned here. I think that everybody agrees, as best I could tell, that increased exports are a short-term imperative at a time when we have a high jobless economy and a need for demand and for things that put people to work. And I think everybody agrees that in a more globalized world, the U.S. has probably been underperforming as an exporter relative to its productivity and economic quality as a country, and that those two things together compel a greater focus on exports. I think everybody thinks that what it means to underperform as an exporter is sort of, as I put it before, that there's a good value proposition that U.S. companies are capable of producing that somehow doesn't get taken up on adequately around the world. And I think we had a good list of factors that were enumerated here. There are lots of structural trade barriers. Some of them are the subject of trade negotiations. Some of them are kinds of things that are probably not the subject of trade negotiation, but that can be an effective focus of our discussions in the future. Second, there are a certain number of self-inflicted wounds. If we don't let our potential customers come to trade shows in the United States, or we make it very burdensome for them to come to trade shows in the United States, we are going to be less successful in selling output. Some of our business, and Bob reminded of this implicitly, in the modern world, not all exports are manufactured. And some of the exports, in the same kind of way, one of the things we teach introductory economics students is that it's an export if a foreign student comes to Harvard, and it's an export if a foreign tourist comes to Disney. And obviously, some of these self-inflicted wounds around infrastructure and our border, in addition to what they mean for future customers of our manufactured exports, have very direct impact on some of our service exports. The great thing about, sort of third, the great thing about the United States is that it's an individualistic country in which there's a lot of individual energy and all of that. Part of success in exports is collaborative activity. Jim emphasized a couple times the collective ecology around small business and big business. There are a lot of economies, in particularly for smaller companies, in the same person or the same government marketing on behalf of multiple suppliers. Figuring out how to collaborate more effectively is something that I think is a very important piece of this. The value proposition that an organization possesses, if it is a U.S. organization, for that to translate into a U.S. export, it has to be economic for that value proposition to be applied in the United States rather than applied abroad. And some of the questions about credit, about discrimination, about tax policy come in there in an important way. I guess the last thing I would say, and I'm not talking about some of the macroeconomic stuff, not because I don't know it's important, but because when I was Secretary of the Treasury, I had the rule that only the Secretary of the Treasury talked about that stuff. And now I'm not Secretary of the Treasury, but I think I should still live by the same rule, but I noticed that we had it. I think the last thing I would say is that people often talk about exports and then they talk about competitiveness in the same breath. And they're closely related subjects. Many of the same things that would make us more effective exporters would also make us more effective competitors with foreign companies here. And it's an extra U.S. job if we sell a Boeing to Air someplace. And it's also an extra U.S. job if we sell a Boeing instead of selling an Airbus to a U.S. company. And as Jim reminds us, one of the major customers in the United States is the U.S. government, and making sure that our guys aren't getting hammered relative to foreign producers is something that's very important. So I think there's a great deal we can do on a variety of things, including a great deal that we could do in the provision of credit. And one of the challenges that I take from this is how to think about, we're not going to have a jobs forum every 3 months, but how we can make sure that the government as an entity is being responsive and staying focused on this export agenda. That's some of what we'll be reporting back to the president. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.